This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. When we think about the possible dangers of nuclear technology, we rarely consider the threat overhead. Day and night, planes armed with nuclear weapons fly overhead as part of our national defense program, and we can't imagine one of those weapons just dropping out of the sky. But that's exactly what happened 50 years ago over the skies of Goldsboro, North Carolina. That is when a B-52 carrying 8 crew members and 2 nuclear bombs caught fire and crashed. The 2 bombs fell thousands of feet as the plane broke apart. They landed in Faro, North Carolina, a small town outside Goldsboro. One was recovered by the military, but the remnants of the other nuclear weapon remain where it fell, and all of those remnants fell 50 years later. Michael Rouse was on the scene that night in 1961. At the time, he was a reporter for the Goldsboro News Argus. Today, he is a retired newspaper editor who lives in Walnut Creek near Goldsboro, and he joins us by phone from his home right now. Mike, welcome.
Thank you, Frank. Nice to be here.
Good to have you here. Take us back to midnight, January 24th, 1961.
Well, at midnight, January 24th, 1961, the telephone rang in my apartment. And at the other end of the line was a friend of mine named Tom Doherty, who was an agent for the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax Unit, as it was called then. Better known as the Revenuers.
They're Revenuers, yeah.
Yeah. Well, this revenueer was, as they used to say, laying on a still. He had staked out an illegal whiskey still in the woods in northern Wayne County. And he saw a big ball of fire going through the sky and went to a telephone to call and tell me that something big was going on, apparently a plane crash. And we both surmised that it was probably something from Seymour Johnson. So I headed out to the in the general direction of where that still was. He gave me directions as best he could, but of course he didn't know precisely where it had landed. But I was fortunate enough to come across it. Oh, before I left, I'd call my editor, managing editor Eugene Price of the News Argus. And I grabbed my camera and went out and found the place. I went down a rise, down a slope, and up a hill, and into an opening on each side of the highway. There was a fire. And as it developed, I learned later that one was where the bomb had fallen, and one was where a lot of the fuselage of the plane was lying, and it was burning. And I went to that field and took pictures, used up all my film, and went back to the office in Goldsboro. Faro is just it's not a town. It's just a sort of a crossroads. A very pleasant community in northern Wayne County.
I want to get you to get this picture for us, because you said you grabbed your camera. 1961, was it one of those cameras with the cone reflector and a flash bulb in the middle?
You got it.
Beautiful. All you need now is the fedora. It's perfect. You're there at the site of this crash.
With a little tag that says press.
But there you are, first at the scene.
I also needed a suitcase to carry that thing, but I didn't have it.
That's right.
But anyway, there were a few people there, too, some of the neighbors who had been startled awake by the crash. But very few, and nobody official. The Air Force did not know that this had happened. It turned out, I later discovered that the base commander was in contact with the pilot of the plane, and he knew it was in trouble, and the operations center at the base knew it was in trouble, but they had no idea that they had lost a plane, and so nobody was there from the base. Well, I went back to the office to get more film, and the AP reporter and photographer arrived from Raleigh, Noel Yancey. I don't know if you remember him or not. But he was a Raleigh correspondent for the AP for many years. And as a matter of fact, I ended up working with him.
Yeah.
When this crash occurred, I was 2 weeks from joining the AP in Charlotte. And that meant that I did not cover some of the aftermath of the crash.
Uh-huh. Well, now, did either one of you see the bombs?
No, we did not see the bombs. But one of the bombs was found hanging from a tree by its parachute. This is a
nuclear bomb, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is probably, by 1961, far more powerful than those that rained terror on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, right?
Far more powerful. But there were all kinds of fail-safes on the bomb. It couldn't go off unless it went through, it automatically went through several processes. Mm-hmm. to in other words, it was effectively disarmed.
Yeah.
Until certain things happened on the bomb. And, of course, none of them had happened. They went out and retrieved the one that was hanging in the tree. I don't know where, but somewhere I've seen a picture of that thing hanging there. And somebody standing there looking at it. I don't think that was a news photograph. I think it was an Air Force photograph that might have been released years later.
Yeah. Because I'm guessing once the Air Force finally got there, they chased you guys away. And if you asked what that was, they'd say it's an apple. Because they don't, right? Because they don't want anybody to know. And then the second, so the one is hanging from a tree. And again, really, nuclear bombs don't hit the ground and blow up. In fact, they're detonated above the ground, and we know they go, as you say, a series of protocols. So it's not like they drop out of the sky, hit the ground, and blow up. But they're still kind of dangerous. The second one actually fell into a marsh?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that it's dangerous. I really don't. I know it sounds silly.
Yeah.
But you know, there are all kinds of fail-safes.
Right.
The second one fell in a field, but it might as well be a marsh. It's real soft ground. And I think there's under the ground, it's even softer. And when they started digging to get it, the more they dig, the deeper it would go. You know, there was that much water in the ground. And it would just sink whenever air got down to to where the weapon was. And it's not the entire weapon. What's left down there is only a part.
Just the nuclear warhead.
It can, well, I don't know if you'd call it the nuclear warhead.
All right.
But
but the point is they could never get it, so what did they end up doing?
They ended up covering up the hole. And paving over it with cement. And they go out and check it and take radiation readings.
And so far, so good, right? I mean,
huh?
So far, so good. I mean, they haven't detected any high radiation levels.
No, there's been no problem with that. And, you know, they're confident, obviously, that it won't go off. And the people in Wayne County don't worry about it. We're accustomed to the Air Force, and they're our neighbors. And, you know, we think they would say if it was dangerous, they'd do something about it.
What about at the time when the story got out? How did people react when they figured out what happened?
Well, I don't think the story just got out suddenly one day. I think it came out in dribs and drabs. That there was something explosive down there.
I'm sorry for interrupting, but I wonder how much did you know that night about the atomic bombs?
That night, I don't think I knew anything about.
Of course, nuclear, we knew not atomic.
There were hydrogen bombs on the plane,
right?
Because at that time, we had B-52s flying 24 hours a day. Mostly up, they went from here north, and, you know, stayed at the ready. That's the one thing about the movie. What was it? Dr. Strangelove.
Mm-hmm.
that's true to life, that we do have those planes out, did have those planes out there. Not anymore.
We should talk, say that there was one lone survivor who survives today. There were several survivors. I think five of the eight aboard survived the crash. One of them is still alive today, and he talks about actually having to hitch a ride into town or to a neighboring.
That was an interesting story. He managed to get out of the plane, even though he was not in an ejection seat. He went out the hole that either the pilot or the co-pilot had through which they had ejected, one of them. And he told me that this was years later. In fact, it was only a few months ago, that the pilot, when he started to eject, turned and looked at him as if to say, and he said he could read it in his eyes, "I know you won't make it, and I'm sorry."
And part of the reason is there are eight crew members and two ejection seats, right?
Something like that.
Yeah.
And but anyway, he had a parachute. And as I understand it, one of the people who was killed was a monitor, an auditor, just not just along for the ride, but without a real job to do because he was just watching what everybody else did. Anyway, this first lieutenant Maddox, Adam Maddox, got out the hole and pulled his ring and opened his parachute, and the parachute tangled. And he said that he started praying, and eventually the parachute unfurled and opened. But when it slowed down, he was then being outrun to the ground by the burning debris from the plane. And he knew that that would hit his chute and that he would be killed. But it didn't happen, and when the debris finished falling, he looked down and he was headed straight into the fire. So he said he continued to pray, but he also pulled the line on that chute so it guided him away from the fire. And as it happened, it guided him into somebody's yard. He was right beside their house, in fact, and landed there with his goggles on and his flight suit and all dirty, and stomped up on the front porch and knocked on the door. And someone came to the door, and he said, "I'm sorry to bother you, but I've been in a plane crash. I'm from Seymour Johnson, and I bailed out. And would you mind taking me to the base?" And the person in the house said, "Not at all, but you will have to wait a while because I think it was his son or his brother had the car and had gone somewhere." They waited a while, visited in the living room. Finally, the car came back. They took him to the base, which was about 18 miles, I guess. When they got to the gate, he was immediately put under arrest. The MPs at the gate, or APs, I guess they called them, weren't aware of any of this, and apparently weren't buying his story, because I guess they thought, you know, if we had a plane crash, we'd know about it. Well, they discussed that back and forth for a while, and finally the pilot of the plane showed up, and say he had gotten somebody to bring him to the gate also. And he interjected himself and said, "Yeah, it's true. I was flying that plane, and yes, it crashed." That's kind of funny, but you know, later we learned the tragic truth that three people had been killed. I think they were all people. I think that monitor, that auditor on the plane, was killed, and that the other two were people who sat in the tail somewhere back there. Those planes were, and still are, not comfortable. There's not a lot of room. You get in your place, and that's where you stay. It's tight quarters. Incidentally, those planes are still flying, although they haven't made them in a long, long time. Most of the B-52s now are older than the fathers of the people who fly the planes.
It's an incredible story.
They're being kept up, of course.
Michael Rouse, what an incredible story. Thank you so much for telling us.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Michael Rouse, author and retired newspaper editor who lives in Walnut Creek, North Carolina, near Goldsboro. That's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. We need to say a special thank you to a person who produced today's conversation on the state of nuclear energy, our spring intern, Bill Kumpf. Bill is a recent graduate of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He has been with us at the State of Things since February. He really is a true asset. He knows his stuff. He's a very smart guy, very witty, and he has inspired his own verb, kumpfing, as in kumpf the guest some coffee, or open the kumpf door. No, kumpf the door, Bill. Is that one of them? Kumpf the door. That's right. And a note of surprise, what the kumpf. Bill Kumpf, we will miss you so much. Our doors are always open to you, and we will bring the coffee when next you arrive. Thank you so much. This is the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio Broadcast Service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.